About, it's our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Denise Lee.
And of course, it is not Denise, but it is Chris. How are you going?
Hello, good afternoon, team. How are you?
Fantastic. Sunny, but dying a little inside.
Right, yeah, it's crazy, actually. Normally the weather's sort of like a small talk kind of intro, isn't it? But actually, it's kind of a big deal at the moment. At the risk of rushing straight into the sort of stand of topics, it's funny actually listening to your report, the weather report at the end of the news, and nervously listening out, wanting rain because it's pretty parched out this part of Auckland, actually all of Auckland really, but for people and teams out here, it's having to recalibrate so we don't say, oh, it's good weather, it's good weather, it's sunny. Well, actually, good weather would be a really good downpour right now. So anyway, yeah.
Let's jump into it straight away in terms of the drought we're seeing in rural Auckland specifically. So for someone in my situation, I don't live in rural New Zealand and I'm not on a tank, so I don't necessarily feel those effects. Can you describe what kind of effects we're seeing in rural New Zealand?
Yeah, sure. It's funny, isn't it? Because Auckland is big enough to include areas that I represent out in sort of Helensville way. So I guess most of your listeners, if they are current university students, might be a bit closer into the centre of town where the university campus is. Mm. But actually, there'll be lots of people who listen now who are also sort of, on water tanks, maybe out sort of in the Waitakere's, also part of my area. And it's actually a really big issue. And it's sort of funny in a way there hasn't been more in the media about it. Mm. But, probably on people like me to sort of jump up and down a little bit more. But it's just a genuinely difficult situation where it's sort of hard to achieve something in the short term when we suddenly look up and realise that there hasn't been any rain for 6 or 7 weeks, as opposed to sort of, more long-term solutions that we should all be working towards. So, yeah, it's just really tough. A lot of people without water for their households and ending up, needing to lean on neighbours, or probably not neighbours actually, in an area that doesn't have access to the sort of the main water system. Their neighbours probably don't have it either, but travel across town for a shower or whatever, which doesn't sound like that much of a hardship when I put it like that, but after several weeks I guess it gets pretty old. Actually it's sort of a bit of an intersection of crises, in the sense we've got people who are probably not many, but at least a few out there who are self-imposed quarantine based on returning from China or other parts where coronavirus is a bit rampant, and then but not being able to get out to get the water that they need because they don't have it near their home. So, a bit of that in terms of the people affected, but also animals. And it's sort of it's been sadly a little bit lacking from the narrative. But again, I'm just sort of trying to get out there. A lot of animals, livestock, who don't have access to water, and are sort of deemed to be a lower priority than humans. But from a welfare point of view. And also, dare I say it, when they're being farmed, it's sort of changed the equation a bit in terms of the number of hungry mouths to feed and the water that these, beasts need to survive. So it's a tough situation.
Mm, absolutely. I did, because what I always do before I talk with any politician is I do a little bit of a Facebook stalking on your page. I did see that in your area someone had implemented like little station for people to fill up water bottles, was it? Or water?
Yeah, that's right. And there's been a bit of that, which has sort of been just the community coming together and organisations and, just individuals being, really good people, actually, and lending a hand in need, et cetera. So there's always those stories, which is really nice. And the official response, so I have to acknowledge, through council and other authorities, there's been a drought declared and there's sort of an understanding of the situation needing solutions. So we've had, for example, I think I'm right in saying we've got them underway now, milk tankers that Fonterra would otherwise be using to ship milk around the place, cleaned out pretty thoroughly, you'd have to hope, and filled up with water. And so they're providing a bit of extra help as well in terms of getting that around the place where it's needed. But yeah, it's just a lot of need in a short space of time, and water's sort of hard to physically move around. Mm. So that's the challenge at the moment, logistical more than anything.
Mm. The most recent news I've heard from government was that they allocated $80,000 as support in the form of like tax relief, emergency grants, and loss of income through a number of agencies. Do you think that addresses some of the major issues that are being experienced, or it doesn't cover it?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I mean, yeah, good on you for doing the research, and you're absolutely right. I guess the first thing I'd note is $80,000 from, you know, Cape Reinga down to the Auckland Harbour Bridge is not a lot of money over quite a large area with a huge amount of need. So, I mean, of course, I would say that, there should be more allocated to that, but if we look at what's actually provided, you're right, it's a bit of grace in terms of period of time to file tax returns and so on for businesses that are affected, and I guess farms would be the obvious one, but probably some other ones as well. But really, the big problem... I will just note as well some sort of emotional support, for want of a better phrase, so people who are really doing it tough from a mental health perspective in these tough times, have got a number they can call. That's the Rural Support Trust. They do great work. And so that, you know, there's some sort of services and resources that are unlocked by the declaration of the drought. But I think the reality is really the best kind of support isn't that ancillary stuff so much as actually just getting some water around the place. And, you know, while it's not falling from the heavens, there's not much that we can do that would be so beneficial as you know, well, a rain dance perhaps sort of seems like a good idea right now, but or maybe to schedule a test match cricket. That's traditionally done it, done the trick. But actually, short of the water coming down in the natural way, it's just sort of getting it around the place is the most useful thing that can happen. So, you know, lots of suggestions coming through. A local government member sort of talked about setting up a static tank where people come and sort of fill up from that, you know, and from surrounding farms. So anyway, lots of hands to the pump, if you'll excuse the expression. Not intentional pun, but yeah, so lots of work being applied to help, but it's just an inherently tough situation.
I'll shift on to our next subject here. So a tax cut package that was somewhat announced by somewhat.
Yeah. Teased. I think we'll say it was teased.
Yes, that's probably a better word for it. So this is something we can expect under national leadership, correct?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in general terms, it's always the way that, the right of politics talks about, allowing more economic freedom in the sense of people to, keep more of their income. The left-wing view, by contrast, would be to have, you know, less of that, but on the other hand, provide more services, you know, they would say, in response to that. So I think everyone would acknowledge it's really a balance. But in terms of where we see the economy at the moment, and partly because the conditions are currently good and allow it, but also because as an ongoing nature of inflation, what we have is a situation where effectively your taxes get increased every year a little bit without anything happening. That's because the levels are set at the same. You know, let's say that up to 70,000 you're paying a certain rate, and then if you don't, but 70,000 in 1 year is worth less than 70,000 in the next year, because of inflation basically and rising costs and so on. So that means you're getting taxed a bit more. So the tax announcement that we have made already was that we would adjust those brackets over time in accordance with inflation, basically. So actually it's not really a cut so much as a non-increase. If you'll forgive the sort of fine distinction there without sort of getting into the details in a way that would lose you all your listeners. So look, that's sort of where we're heading, and it's a declaration of intent more than anything at the start of election year, and there'll be much more to come.
I think lots of people heard that and immediately kind of got concerned that this would be an expected cut to services.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, we've got to be clear about the fact that wouldn't happen. To some extent it's about being able to do more with less. But, you know, I think there's no appetite in New Zealand for cut services in consideration for a tax cut. But the reality is, you know, for what it's worth, looking backwards, the record of the last National Lib government was actually huge increases in health and education, all those key things that people really care about. There was a bit of scaremongering, to put it kindly, from opposition parties at the time, who said, oh, you know, National's going to, you know, National's cut spending in health by, you know, whatever amount. And what they actually meant was that National wasn't going to increase it by as much as they thought that was needed.
Well,
we can always have a debate about the levels and so on, but, I just hope we're going to have an honest campaign in terms of what's happened in the past and what, you know, and that's incumbent on all parties to be upfront and say, well, this is the trade-off, this is what we're offering.
I guess what I would kind of say in a rebuttal to that is that we can always, basically with any new party implemented into politics, see an increase in health spending, particularly.
Yep.
That always consistently happens. It's just kind of a question about how much do you increase that spending by?
Yeah, well, I think that's a fair comment, but I would also say, and actually just to the point of natural increases, it's the same as you know, tax burden, but in reverse, you know, as the population grows and as services cost more from inflation, if nothing else, then of course you need to increase it, even just to stand still. So, you know, I think, you know, to suggest that there'd actively be cuts from any party is probably a bit silly. But the question really, actually, I think the big challenge for all of us is to say, well, how have we got a, you know, what kind of plan have we got to actually make outcomes better? Because, you know, we can all sit in Wellington and pat ourselves on the back that we've spent more on this or spent more on that. But the reality is, if, you know, there aren't more operations or there isn't a higher rate of immunisation or whatever the measure is, and, you know, a couple of health ones there, but education or any other metric, or any other area, you can use any metric you like to measure it. So are things better for the people on the ground is the question. Not what are the numbers inside a glossy budget document that make politicians feel good about themselves. So that's the measure I think that we should all be held to. So we'll sort of be pretty focused on a target-based approach for that reason.
Be interesting to see what those targets are. I'll shift on to our last subject, something that you're quite involved with. So in terms of the right to silence debate, for those who don't know what the right to silence is, could you explain that and why you're kind of proposing to abolish it?
Yeah, sure. I certainly respectfully picked you up on the point about abolishing it. I don't think, I don't think anyone's proposing to abolish the right to silence, per se. But if I can just take a step back, sometimes it's easier to talk about these things by way of example.
Mm-hmm.
So recently we heard, you know, the nation learned of an awful situation, which, you know, no one would say isn't absolutely horrendous, whereby a young boy, I think 4 years old, was brutally beaten and has suffered, you know, irreparable damage and massive damage. You know, sort of best case scenario, he lives that is massively disabled for the rest of his life. And in that scenario, whereby, as I understand it, just from public reporting, you know, not relying on any particular knowledge of the case, it sounds as though we might have another of those situations where there are people who know what happened and are not prepared to come forward and say that, and thereby assist, you know, the wheels of justice to turn and to do the right thing, essentially, by this little boy and the rest of society. You know, goodness knows that there are other children involved in that family who might be at risk as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the stakes are pretty high. It's a pretty serious issue. But at the same time, you know, going back many years, centuries, in fact, in the legal system that we inherited from elsewhere, you've basically got the right to remain silent. Certainly, if the police come and say, what's going on here, you don't have to say anything. It might be used against you in court later, so you've given that warning. And I don't think anyone's proposing to remove that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got a situation where in court, you don't have to give evidence that would incriminate yourself. That's enshrined in our New Zealand Bill of Rights Act, and again, it goes back a long way. So you can not answer any question if you think it might, you know, you might be dobbing yourself in. However, where I think there is appetite for change out there, albeit with some caution, rightly so, is where a situation where a person who's not charged with a crime but knows very well what happened, you know, the suggestion is, and including from my party, that it's appropriate to say, well, if you don't speak up and don't, you know, it's effectively like obstructing justice, but in a passive way as opposed to an active way. And so we're just exploring whether there might be an appropriate balance to be struck where we say, well, actually, we do want to know what the hell happened so that we can stop this kind of thing happening again. I've had a members' bill actually in the ballot in Parliament now for about 18 months, so it's not a knee-jerk thing and it's not a, you know, it's not a populist thing that happens to be an election yet. It's something I've genuinely thought about. We need to balance this a lot better. And so that's slightly different again. That's saying, well, if you do want to remain silent, perfectly welcome to. We're not abolishing that right, but it might be that the jury thinks that there's something, some reason for that they should take into account. So
it's
a complex area. That's probably enough detail, but But let's just say it's sort of a work in progress. I think that's something that the nation is probably going to be watching pretty closely.
So just to be clear, you are not criminalising that right?
Well, I mean, it depends what you're talking about. Not the right to remain silent in your own defence, but for people who were present in a situation where a small child is being beaten to death and they know about it, and it can be proven that they know about it beyond reasonable doubt, then yes, we are proposing that there be some sort of consequence for that.
But Section 95A of the Crimes Act, it appears that already is somewhat covered under that.
So someone can
already face up to 10 years imprisonment if they're already aware of child abuse occurring and don't report it. Why is this different?
I think with respect, the difference between Section 195A of the Crimes Act and what we're talking about here is that is more a duty to intervene to protect, you know, let's say the child in that situation, as opposed to a scenario where the thing has already happened and we're in a courtroom situation where they are being asked to speak up and say what did happen. So a duty to disclose rather than a duty to protect, if you follow that distinction, if I've sort of set that out clearly enough.
That's a fair distinction.
Yeah.
Andrew Little has also made the comment that he wants to know whether this will add anything or whether it is just populist talk. Is this just populist talk?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, I wish it was a one-off problem that had been faced in this particular family situation. And while it's pretty hard to sort of say out loud, I think probably if that were the case, the result would be that we'd probably not hear much more about it. But the reality is this problem's gone back way in the past. I mean, you remember the horrendous situation of the Kahui twins, you know, wagons were circled and the shop was shut up and we had great difficulty finding out what happened in that case, resulting in lack of justice for them. And, you know, if we'd done something about it then, more robust than what we did, and, you know, acknowledged there were some things done at the time, and you've just mentioned that quite rightly. But, you know, if we'd done more things then maybe the situation now, we wouldn't be staring down the barrel of a situation where actually in reality we can't do anything about this particular one, because, you know, they'll be tried according to the law at the time that the offence occurred. So look, it is pretty depressing because it's a long-running issue. Therefore, it's not a matter of populism. It's not a knee-jerk thing. It's not a one-off. And like I say, it's something, you know, that personally I turned my mind to at least 2 years ago, pretty much as soon as I came into Parliament, and have had it sitting in the ballot waiting for it to be pulled, because if there's anything I can do to help avoid this kind of awful situation in the future, then I'm certainly going to take that chance.
I might just jump back to the kind of 95A of the Crimes Act, as well as this kind of proposition. Some might point to this and say that it undoubtedly would affect parents who are also experiencing domestic violence in the home. Do you think this law change would understand the nuances of domestic violence in New Zealand?
Yeah, look, that's a very, very good question, and it's one that we should, you know, consider really in very good faith. The reality is that the law there, and anyone that we would put forward, would have to take into account that kind of circumstance. So phrases like "without reasonable excuse" or "in the circumstance," or in the circumstances, would specifically mandate judges to take into account the fact that, you know, it might be, you know, and just excuse me being stereotyping here on gender lines, but, you know, by way of example, you know, it might be that there's a woman who is the mother of a child who's also receiving abuse from, you know, a guy, and she might be in fear of her own life. And it's also the case, and again, my members' bill does take into account the scenario that it might be the situation where a witness is leaned on, or someone who is accused of committing a crime might actually be leaned on by someone to, you know, remain silent, and that would be a reasonable excuse for not speaking up. Or it might be that they were doing some other dodgy thing at the time, and they don't want to give their alibi for why they didn't commit the murder at this address here, because they were, you know, doing something dodgy over here, and in which case, well, that's a reasonable sort of defence to give and explanation. So, you know, there are subtleties in the law to take into account exactly that situation that you raised.
I just got a text in. I might read it out to you now. They've said, if everyone stays quiet, then how do we know who actually knows anything? It's all well and good to say people who are present must come forward, but how do you know who that is if no one does come forward?
Oh, well, that's in the realm of the detective work, basically. I mean, your correspondent is quite right. It might be that we don't know. We might not know if anyone was in, well, you know, we might not positively know that any given person was in the house at the time or should have known, in which case the threshold of the offence isn't going to be met, because you can't say beyond reasonable doubt that someone knows something about a situation if they weren't there. But sometimes we do know that a person was there. You know, we've got all kinds of ways that the police can, determine, or someone might admit that they were there. They might say, I was in the house at the time, but I didn't hear anything. I was watching a movie in another room or something. If that's the case, then they're not going to be guilty of the offence, because, you know, then they haven't met the elements of that. Certainly not to a threshold of beyond reasonable doubt, which continues to apply throughout the whole criminal law. So, look, good question, but the reality is that, you know, it's hard to prove a negative. You know, it's hard to, I can't prove that I wasn't, well, I probably could actually, but, you know, if you said, can you prove that you weren't in that particular household at that particular time? Well, unless I can, you know, pull out a diary entry that I was somewhere else, then, you know, theoretically, it could have been me. But, for example, just to sort of be personalised, because I don't want to sort of put that out there about anyone else, but, you know, like, it's, this is why we have a law that has these kind of mechanisms where we have the ability for people to say, well, I didn't do it, and that to be tested in court. And if they're not guilty, they're not guilty, and they're presumed innocent. If they're not guilty, then it can't be established as such, then they remain presumed innocent and walk free.
I will finish off on my last question, which I like to have a personal one, to take it out of the heavy realm of politics for a second.
Yeah.
This question actually comes from a friend of mine, Peter Witten. Peter has a very important question for you, Chris. He wants to know what your favorite meme page is.
Favorite meme page?
Yes.
Oh, I love that. Your friend Peter is a discerning fellow to be asking such a question. I highly approve.
He's a wise man.
Yeah, indeed. And I say that not to play for time while I think of one. Well, look, I'm sorry, I'm going to give a probably a pretty obvious political answer, which is there's a group, and I'm going to give a shout-out now on Facebook, called National Party Meme Working Group. there's also some rival accounts from other parties, but of course I'm not going to give them any publicity,
because
they'll be ragging on us, I suspect. We're ragging on them. So anyway, they come up with lots of good stuff. It's pretty cheeky, but and pretty harmless stuff. It's not intended to be mean. Or nasty, so that's always a good time.
I mean, that is exactly the answer we were hoping for. Thank you, Chris.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. You have a lovely day.
Thanks so much. You too.
Bye.
The National Party's Denise Lee on 95 BFM.